State and Federal Affairs to order Thursday, July 28, 2005. I'd like to have Senator Carter, is she here yet? Senator Gordley, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to bring up Angela Kimball to join me.
Fine.
And I'm assuming that this is the work session on Senate Bill 1.
It is.
Thank you. Let me say, first of all, for the record, my name is Avelle Gordley. And I represent Senate District 23, which includes Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I have so looked forward to this day. I come before you as the parent of a son who lives with mental illness. My son Tyrone is now 39. He's a Navy veteran. His diagnosis is paranoid schizophrenia. He has a life that he is living well today thanks to medication that works well for him and that, in fact, has given him his life back. He works as a peer counselor with Cascadia Behavioral Health Care in Portland. And again, he is living his life out loud, so to speak, after years, more than a dozen years, of being in and out of hospitals, being in jail settings. But again, because there are blessings and because prayer does work and because medication works, he has his life back. I also come to you as a member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and I'm very proud to stand with them on this day. And I want to bring you a brief message, a very somewhat brief message from a dear friend. His name is Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson, and Dr. Knight Richardson is currently on the faculty of the Oregon Health Sciences University, where he serves as director of public psychiatry, their training program. But Dr. Knight Richardson also served on the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health, which was created by President Bush back in April of 2002. And Dr. Knight Richardson wrote to the speaker recently at my request. And he said the following, that recently it was my privilege to serve on President Bush's New Freedom Mental Health Commission. The findings of the commission led to the conclusion that the mental health system in the United States is badly broken. In fact, I led the argument that there is no system. Chief among the causes of a failed system is the stigmatization of mental illness. This stigmatization is grounded in the primitive, false belief that mental illnesses are not the result of brain, physiological, or structural malfunction, but are flaws in the fabric of an individual's soul or spiritual poverty or weakness of will. Modern science has dispelled these myths, and we now know with certainty that mental illnesses are illnesses based in the brain's malfunction, not unlike diseases that result from other human organ malfunction. And Dr. Richardson, Knight Richardson, went on to say in his letter to Speaker Menas that stigmatization is the reason that mental illnesses are negatively differentiated in the way we pay for treatments. Thus, mental health insurance programs are carved out, carved up, or carved away. The benefits exist separately from other medical benefits. They are generally very restrictive and segmented over service lines. They often do not exist at all. This is wrong, unjust, and inhumane. Our country would never accept such a discriminatory system for cancer or diabetes or heart disease or kidney disease or even forms of genetic diseases. And so we have in this legislation before you, Mr. Chair, and my colleagues, what Dr. Knight Richardson describes as the opportunity to save more lives, to salvage more futures, to unburden more families, and to begin being more just. What I would like to conclude with is a statement from the President's New Freedom Commission, and again, this was a commission that did its work, started its work in 2002. The President's Commission vision statement reads as follows: "We envision a future when everyone with a mental illness will recover, a future when mental illnesses can be prevented or cured, a future when mental illnesses are detected early, and a future when everyone with a mental illness at any stage of life has access to effective treatment and supports, essentials for living, working, learning, and participating fully in the community." I ask my colleagues on this day to vote in support of this bill and to do so with enthusiasm. It is now time to send a clear signal, a clear message to all of Oregon that we are leaving discrimination and stigma and stereotype behind, and we are about ending discrimination now. I thank you very much.
We'll make sure everybody realizes we are in work session, and I wanted to give the good senator an opportunity to be first before I say anything, before staff said anything. She's been an advocate for long before I got to this building for this issue, and seeing it come together, I think, gratifies everybody. So I don't think I'll have staff go into the actual bill. We know what it is. We've read it. But I really appreciate now for the other two people to testify for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Margaret Carter, House Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. I was thinking about what I wanted to say to you as I was walking over here. This is the 20th year that I have been on Human Services Committee. It's the 20th year that I've been working on mental health issue. It is the 18th year from the time and in which I, as the chair of a committee, just stopped the committee because of what was happening with mental health in our state, and how we have had a practice as a legislature that when things go wrong in physical health, and we need more money, if there was money available in the behavioral health area, we would go over and lobby behavioral health to pay for physical health. It's a practice that we have had for as long as I've been here, for the 20 years I have been here. And it needs to stop. And it also, now I've seen two generations of young people that we could have helped in their youth become adults and become more heavily engaged in medication simply because they did not have mental health services available to them. Children's mental health is an imperative for us. Mental health, period, but children's mental health, because we're talking about generations going into the future where the problem becomes more exacerbated as a result of not having enough treatment programs and the proper kind of medical protocols given to them in this state. And so somewhere along the line, we could help to better manage mental health when we start working with our children. But as long as we continue to allow powers that be to keep us from having parity in our healthcare system, the more likely we are going to have more people going into the future with mental health diseased states. And so unless we, as the legislature says, that we're going to bring about parity and that we're going to, there are so many people who are able to work in this society that we're going to be able to help them to maintain themselves in the revenue stream and be participants in society, is simply by being able to fund a mental health system in this state, then we're going to continue to go down the wrong trail, and then we're going to see more people going into our emergency care system simply because we have not taken care of the needs that we could have prior to them getting to such agitated states or such needed states in this state. And so I applaud this committee, and I hope that you will pass out this bill today so that we can have mental health parity in this state and try to keep as many people in the workforce as we possibly can, especially should we look at trying to develop a strong system of care for our kids in this state in terms of mental health. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, first of all, I want to say that it is with the deepest sense of gratitude that I come before you today to reflect on an issue of extraordinary significance for so many Oregonians, parity of health insurance for mental health and substance abuse disorders. But I really want to begin by thanking House leadership for their support of parity. And I want to thank the remarkable bipartisan coalition of legislators who have acknowledged the need to treat mental illness and addictions with understanding, with compassion, and above all, with fairness. And Senate Bill 1 does just that. It simply requires that coverage for these disorders be no less than an insurance plan's coverage for other health conditions. And 2 years ago, a 14-year-old boy came before this legislative body because he wanted to speak about how mental health and substance abuse and the lack of insurance parity had affected his life. When he was finished, 9 members of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee stood up and applauded the boy who fought back tears as he told his story. And I believe that hearts and minds were changed that day, and that strong bipartisan accord began. And in that interim time, a growing understanding of mental illness and its impact, the effectiveness of treatment, and the true cost of parity have resulted in unprecedented support, support for fair coverage that is spread throughout our nation. The cost of fair coverage? 35 states have parity laws, and we know the results. Costs have been nominal, 1-2%, and often less. Our federal employees have parity of health insurance coverage, and the cost has been 1.3%. Our own state employees' parity costs less than 0.5%. And here in Oregon, the Association of Oregon Counties asked City County Insurance Services to do their own estimate, and they estimated a cost of 1% or less, just a penny for every dollar spent on health insurance coverage. And what I want to point out is that despite that nominal cost, some have feared that parity will cause employers and employees to drop insurance, increasing the ranks of the uninsured. But this assertion hasn't been borne out by the experience throughout this country. The 4 states, for example, with the most comprehensive parity laws on the books, all have lower uninsurance rates and higher rates of employer coverage than Oregon. Even more importantly, I believe businesses have been discovering that the cost of absenteeism, the cost of lost productivity, and disability claims due to untreated mental illness have been greater than the cost of mental health parity. The cost of depression in the workplace, for example, is so great that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce helped launch a website designed to calculate the cost of workplace depression for businesses, and more importantly, to articulate the return on investment of adequate mental health benefits. And as many have pointed out, the cost of mental illness goes far beyond the workplace. Mental health disorders disrupt our classrooms. They overwhelm our prisons, our jails, our child welfare systems, and profoundly affect our communities and families and the 1/6 of our returning troops coming home from Iraq. While mental illnesses that are treated too late, too little, or not at all can be devastating, I want to remind you that the right care at the right time can result in amazing recovery, where a mental health condition is controlled and managed just like any other chronic condition. 2 years ago, as I drove past our crumbling state hospital, I used to fear that one day my son would end up there. But since then, I need to tell you, my son has managed his medications. He's graduated from high school. He's been accepted into college. And in what I consider a triumph of American capitalism in his own recovery, he has made enough money from his artwork to buy his first car. And I want to add that in a rather ironic twist that makes even him smile, his best-selling design, of which you have a copy, his best-selling design is adapted from a purloined piece of linoleum from Damage State Hospital. He has faced his greatest fears and now lives with hope and joy. And on this historic day, your support of Parity brings comfort to his brother, the young man who came before this legislature 2 years ago, and hope and joy to families and communities throughout Oregon. And for this, we truly, truly thank you.
Angela, can you at the end here state your name for the record?
For the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs and also a parent.
Okay. Senator Gordley, we kind of heard a lot of testimony already that skirted around costs. Can you give us maybe your insight how we might measure the long-term savings from investing up front in mental health?
What I would like to do, with your permission, Mr. Chair, so as not to take up the time of others behind me who can speak very eloquently and very clearly to your question, is ask Gina
Furman.
Gina Furman. To come forward. And again, there are others who can.
Okay, when we get them up, we'll ask them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Scott Brown, Representative Brown, is he still here? There he is. Is Representative Tomei still here?
She won't pass her leave.
Okay. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Scott Bruin. I'm the representative from District 37, which is Tualatin and West Lynn and Stafford. I appreciate you having letting me testify this morning briefly, and I promise to be very brief. I know you've heard a lot of testimony, and you will hear a lot more. My interest in this is less personal than others. I thank goodness have had nobody in my immediate family affected by mental health issues. But I come at this from two perspectives. One is as an individual, as an extremely blessed individual, and I'm referring to myself. And the reason I say that I am blessed, I'm somebody who suffers from type 1 diabetes, I am a cancer survivor, and I have rheumatoid arthritis. Untreated, I'd be dead. Marginally treated, I would be marginal, to say the least. But because I have been lucky to have excellent insurance my entire life, I live, I would think, a very productive life, and I am a mountain climber. I think there should be no difference between the help and the assistance that I've received as somebody with physical mental impairments. I think there should be no difference between that and somebody who has mental impairments. And the reason I say that is because both lead directly to quality of life, to productivity in life. There's no difference between physical illness, in my opinion, and mental illness. And in fact, in a lot of cases, I would argue, a physical illness, you're able to perform better than a mental illness. One of my examples, for example, is rheumatoid arthritis. Left untreated, I'd be in a wheelchair. But my brain would still be fully operational, of course, and I could do things that only my brain could do. That's why I think that mental health is just as, if not more important than physical. The other perspective I come at this is from an employer. Many of you know that I work for a contractor in Portland. We're a small business. We're a typical Oregon small business. We range, depending on the month, between 40 and 50 employees. There's no question in my mind, first of all, that there will be a cost to this. I don't think it'll be a material cost. I think it's indeterminate at this point how big the cost would be. I've heard 1%, I've heard 4 or 5%. Your question, Mr. Chair, to what is the effect on employers, I can address that easily. There's so much loss in time and productivity when we have an employee who, for whatever reason, has depression issues, and I'm not a doctor, so I'll certainly won't get the terminology right, but chemical imbalance issues or worse. There's no way to measure the cost of that to a small business like myself compared to maybe a 1%, maybe a 4% increase in our monthly insurance costs. So from that perspective, from the perspective of an individual that's blessed, and from the individual of from the perspective of an individual who is an employer, I absolutely support Senate Bill 1, mental health parity, and I would ask this committee's favorable aye vote on that issue when you vote on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Krieger, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman, and I'm the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I think your question was to costs. I did not plan to speak today because Angela Kimball works for me, and also we have Mike Wilkerson, who will come up from the Sheriff's Association and talk to address some of these issues. I also believe that other people are going to be covering this information. What I would like to do, if it's okay with you to save time, if you have specific questions, because we've blanketed you with so much information in the interim, I see heads nodding. If you have specific questions about costs, I would be glad to take notes and get those answers to you rather than listening to me ramble on for 5 minutes with statistics. Whatever your pleasure.
You can do that, although we are going to move the bill today.
Okay.
And so any information that we can get, we'll go down through the list. If you don't have any specific numbers or statements to make regarding the benefits that will reduce costs in the future, that's fine. We'll be having Mike and Vince up here in a minute and Stan Backhauer. So
the one thing that I would like to point out that I know that all of you know is that the 1 to 2%, actually 0.46% to 2%, that has been estimated that the costs on the front end of parity will be. There's several companies that have estimated cost. It's hard to tell in Oregon what the benefits will be yet, but we're seeing a tremendous workforce load issue that is a benefit when people are on their medications and stabilized. There's not as many days off work. That's something to think about. There's a lot of issues like that parity will help.
Committee members, do you have any questions of the two witnesses? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Mike Wilkerson, Vince Salvi, and Stan Baumhofer come up, please. Please just state your names for the record, and then you can proceed in any order that you might like.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Wilkerson, Undersheriff for the Marion County Sheriff's Office.
My name is Vince Salvi. I am here as a parent of a mentally ill young man, and I live in Southwest Portland.
Whichever one of you wants to go ahead and start, and then you can just,
start, go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Mike Wilkerson. Part of my job involves certainly the responsibility of providing supervision for a jail and a work center, which has, in Marion County, capacity of 672 beds. In addition, I also provide some supervision for parole and probation in Marion County, which has about 3,700 offenders being supervised in this particular community. I'd certainly want to share with you a recent survey that was compiled by the Center of Juvenile and Criminal Justice at Western University on the population here of our jail. The survey wasn't necessarily commissioned exactly for this particular bill, but it was involving some other project that we're working on. But I think some of the data is applicable here, and I'd like to share just a couple of key points, some of the data here. They went ahead and surveyed at July 9th, so it's recent data here, just a couple of weeks old, 442 offenders that were in custody here in Marion County. Out of that, some of the findings include 74% of those folks have used meth. 73% have kids, which represent 329 children in our community. So you can start to see the impact and the ripple effect it has. 34% were diagnosed with mental illness. 29% have actually received some type of mental health services while they were in custody. So I share that data with you. I think the impact it has, just because of the rippling impact it has on other services in our community. The other thing I want to share with you is that I really want to encourage you to look at how you can divert and do anything possible to divert these people out of the criminal justice system. The other thing that I'd like to add in the brief time I have is Marion County is also a member of the Partners in Crisis statewide committee, and that committee really is focusing on trying to divert these people out of the criminal justice system. Criminal justice system is an extremely expensive process for many of these people to go through. And certainly at the sheriff's office, you can see by and tell by the data, certainly in our community, in our custody, and in the jail, anything that you could do to help these people access services in the community would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have to also thank you greatly for this opportunity to briefly describe my personal experience. I was asked to speak to our family circumstances, and exactly 5 years ago, we were struggling with the first hospitalization of our son, who at the time was 16 years old, and was hospitalized at the Legacy Emanuel facility in Portland for what at the time for us was something absolutely terrifying and unexplained. He had had a severe mental break, as that described to us, but the doctors couldn't tell us what it was, how long he'd be in the hospital, what his prognosis would be, or even what the treatment would be. He was released from the hospital after about 10 days, was hospitalized again in August, was hospitalized again in September, was hospitalized again in October, and as you might imagine, we ran out of insurance coverage. That was a huge surprise to me because I wasn't familiar enough with the way that our policy treated mental health coverage. The long and short was, after many hospitalizations, incredible intensive efforts by a terrific set of doctors and counselors, we were able to bring Nick home, but he still suffered enormously. We have only recently, in the last 6 months, seen our older son stable. It's been almost a five-year process. But I wanted to piggyback, I think, on what Angela said. Through a great deal of effort, dedicated people, medication, a real heroic effort by an enormous number of people, including my own family, I think our son is stable. He will never probably have the mental ability unless there is some great breakthrough. He has schizoaffective disorder. He has massive cognitive loss. And yet I also celebrate his ability to enjoy life and participate in some activities that give him great joy and also joy for us. He's a young, compassionate man. He would not be where he is today without a network of help that was available to him. For us, parity won't help him, but it certainly will help a massive number of people who need coverage. I have a coworker right now that's in the hospital who had been struggling with what she thought and had been diagnosed with as depression over many, many years. In fact, she was hospitalized when my son was hospitalized 5 years ago. She's just been diagnosed with bipolar. and I have been trying to support her in every way possible and saying that there is good treatment and she needs to stick with it. And I think the point that I wanted to share with you is that 5 years ago, parity would not have meant just giving us some economic relief because it was enormously costly for us, but it would have allowed, if in fact Nick needed to go back in the hospital after the fourth time, him to try and stay close to us. And that was enormously helpful. For him to be treated in Providence allowed us to see him on a frequent basis, to work with his doctors, to work with his counselors, to put together a plan that very, very slowly allowed him to regain some independence. And that was phenomenally valuable. That socialization truly is something which is critical for, I think, recovery. I had passed out for you, I don't know how many of you have seen it before, a study that was done 2 years ago, I guess, or a year and a half ago, on insurance discrimination. There are numerous stories in there everywhere around the state of what the impact of lack of coverage meant. And I just, you know, looking back at the very first story, Betty Griffin, I talked about her 13-year-old daughter having 5 days of hospital coverage left, and then she was released. When my son was released from Providence the last time he was there, he was on a 33 out of 100 scale of functionality. We constantly felt for months that he'd have to be back in the hospital because we couldn't manage him. But we tried and tried, and we kept at it, and we kept him at home. When I read stories like Betty's, when I talk to, I can't tell you how many people over the last 5 years who've experienced this issue, it has been such a painful thing to think that we discriminate against mental illness. So I'm here to ask you, and my son asked me directly, Nick asked me to ask you to pass this to the floor because it's the right thing to do and will help so many people. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stan Baumhofer, a retired businessman from Portland. Been active in business over 50 years there and still active in several business enterprises. In the nearly 40 years that I've been watching the legislative process, I've not seen an issue that has had such varied and wide support as the parity issue. There must be something right about it. And from a business standpoint, this has been portrayed incorrectly as an expensive mandate. Again, from a business standpoint, we get stuck with all of the costs of running all of the services that we approve here. In this case, you're going to be saving us some money, because in the long run, in our criminal justice expenses, in our human resource expenses, they're the ones that are going to benefit from having this parity service available. Oregon, and thus we should be proud to include Oregon as the 36th state to have parity included in its benefits. Thank you for passing this issue.
Okay. Committee members, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you very much. We're going to finish this bill, and we'll probably carry Senate Bill 1083 over till 1 o'clock, even though the floor starts. We'll be right up and try to get that done. Right now, I'd like to have Elise Brown, John Powell, and Liza Trussell come up, please. Was there anyone else that needed to come up that we didn't know about? Fine, thank you. Representative, just a second. Representative Boone, I didn't see you in the back. Did you want to testify shortly? I'll let you finish up if it's okay just when they're done. I think you probably have an opposite view here.
I can still say good morning for the next few minutes, so I'll start with saying good morning. My name is Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans. We're a national association representing nearly 1,300 members across the country with health insurance coverage for 200 million Americans. Our members here in Oregon are Regents, Kaiser, Pacific Care, HealthNet, and ODS. And it's difficult to be here today in opposition. See only two of us. And over the course of this session, there has been lots and lots of dramatic testimony on mental health parity. You've heard from witnesses, from group health, individual, and self-insured, uninsured, and the Medicaid population. But Senate Bill 1's target population is only one segment of Oregon's population, and that is those covered by the commercial group insurance. AHIP and its members certainly recognize behavioral health treatment is a very critical part of our overall health and well-being. But benefit expansion comes with trade-offs. Currently, Oregon has 25 mandates on the books. And this legislative body, just over the course of the last several months, has passed three more. Those are colorectal cancer screenings, prostate screenings, and breast exams. With the addition of mental health parity, we'll be at 29 mandates in Oregon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I just need to be very clear as a member of the health industry that if Senate Bill 1 were to pass, just a few key points. Bottom line, premiums are going to go up. Many of Oregon's businesses are going to be in a very difficult decision-making mode. They will have to decide, number one, are they going to be able to continue to cover the employee? And if so, can they cover the spouse and the kids? Lisa will be able to tell you a little bit more about that. So with those things add up to higher number of uninsured Oregonians. I really do appreciate the opportunity to share my comments on Senate Bill 1, and I know well the importance of addressing the issue, as I have a sister who's mentally ill. She's lived with mental illness her entire adult life, and thankfully she's on the Oregon Health Plan. But if she were to lose her benefits, she and others like her, Oregonians most vulnerable, would not be served by Senate Bill 1. So I do share the concerns and the pain of many that have gone before me and testified during this legislative session. But as a representative of the industry, it's my responsibility to remind you that with the passage of this bill that includes the other mandates that have already passed, our health care system in Oregon is going to cost more. And I just needed to say that today. So I appreciate, again, the opportunity and happy to answer any questions after Lisa's testimony.
Good noon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and I'm here today to voice our concerns in opposition to Senate Bill 1. And it's not that our members don't share the same concerns that the general community does about adequate mental health coverage and care being available. But we do have, as the state does, limited resources on which to provide benefits to our employees. And as Elise pointed out to you, this bill targets only group health insurance plans. So for my larger employers or some of my medium-sized employers who have been on the fence about self-insurance, the changes that we've made this session to group insurance, including if with the expected passage of this mental health parity bill, those groups will probably easily roll into self-insurance. And the reason they'll do that is because the mandates you pass don't impact them. My smaller members, what I've distributed to you is a chart that the insurance division put out. And when I was speaking on this bill in the Senate, I was using the fourth quarter of 2004. Those numbers have gone up with the first quarter of 2005, which is what you presented. But what I wanted to point out was over in the third column where it talks about the PPO plans, those are pretty general plans that are available for the small employer health insurance market. Right now, the cheapest employee plus family coverage available is $844, and that's in Region 3, which is basically Marion and Marion County and Marion and Polk, I think. At the high end for employee plus dependent family coverage, it's at $2,089 a month, and that's up in the Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington County area. So the reason I point this out to you is that the cost impacts that we heard in the Senate were about 2 to 2.5% in the private market. They said the PEB experience was 0.5%, but that I don't think would carry over to the general small employer group market, because I believe PEB started with a higher benefit. So they're starting here and went to here, where the other group market would be starting here and going to there. So even if you assume that the 2 to 2.5% increase is what the average would be, the last numbers that we have available indicated that a 1% increase in Oregon equated to a 3,000 Oregonians losing insurance. So at 2 to 2.5%, you're looking at 6,000 to 6,500 people that'll lose coverage. Now, I'm not telling you that my members are going to rush out and cancel their insurance that are in the group market. I am telling you I think people will seriously look at self-insurance as an option. And for most of the small group market, I think that it's safe to say that the employer typically pays the employee-only contribution, and then the employee picks up the dependent coverage. So if it is at 2 to 2.5%, probably the employer can pick it up. What will happen, I believe, is that the employee that could be the straw that breaks their back on covering the picking up the dependent coverage. So you have far more information and data than I do, but you have to realize that is the offsetting of people losing in coverage worth the other issues that would be involved with providing the coverage. The undersheriff had made a comment about the statistics about how many of the people had mental health conditions, and my question on that would be how many of those individuals had access to group health insurance that this bill would impact anyway. But there's, as we pointed out, Elise pointed out, there's been 25 current mandates on the book. It would have been our thought in the Senate that if this was the issue that we should be going forward with, then was there maybe 2 to 2.5% that we could cut out of the current mandates and take them off the books and replace them with this? And apparently that was not an option that anybody wanted to seriously look at. So with those comments, I'll stop. I just want to represent that it'll come at it will increase the number of uninsureds, and whether that is a benefit that's offset by the improvement in the other services is a policy decision you'd have to make.
Okay. Committee members, do you have any questions? Don't believe so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Boone, do you want to come up for a moment, please?
Hi, for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the Upper Left Coast, and a very high incidence of mental illness in my district. Therefore, I'm coming to you in support of Senate Bill 1, very, very supportive. This has been a top priority of mine for many, many years, and I appreciate the opportunity that you're giving this issue to hear this bill today, and I hope that you move it out. One of the things, I'm not a physician, but I can say I know that the brain is part of the body, and I believe that we should be treating it the same as the rest of the body, and we wouldn't cut off a diabetic's treatment after 10 or 12 visits, and I don't think we should do the same for, we shouldn't do that for mental illness. So that being said, I think that everybody can say they know somebody, either in their family or their group of friends or their coworkers, who deals with mental illness. And if they don't, I can tell you that just like 1 out of 10 drivers coming at you may be drunk, it's true, they are. And sometimes just the difference between having the insurance coverage and the ability to pay for medications keeps a person in their job, keeps them together enough to live a productive and useful life, and when they don't have it, they can spin out of control, and that becomes a problem for all of us. So I think that we heard a lot about money and how much things are going to cost, and losing this opportunity, what it would mean, the mandates. I look at the mandates that we have, that and some of the bills we just passed, the colorectal screening, the PSAT or PST or whatever it's called for prostate cancer, the women's health initiatives we just passed and signed in the governor's office just a few minutes ago. These are all prevention tactics, and this is what we should be doing. It saves money in the long time. In the long run, it keeps people healthier, and that's where we should be. And then finally, I'd like to say, we as state workers and the people under the PEBB all receive these benefits, and it seems only fair that we should extend them to the rest of Oregonians. So thank you very much.
Any questions, committee members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I add a couple of points about cost?
If you'd like to, thank Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much for allowing me to come back, Mr. Chairman, just to get a couple of points on to the record. There was a study that I would commend to the committee, Insurance Parity for Mental Health, authored by Dr. Ruth Kirchstein, Cost, Access, and Quality, a final report to Congress by the National Advisory Mental Health Council, National Institutes of Health. This is June 2000. Their finding is that recent experience in the states in which legislation requires parity of mental health, substance abuse, and physical health coverage proves that implementing parity benefits results in minimal, if any, increase in total health care costs. The experience in the state of California was that there was no evidence that employers, large or small, were dropping health care coverage. That's upon implementation of parity in California. The experience in Vermont was that only 0.3% of employers reported dropping coverage for their employees because of the new parity law. Again, just to get some additional comments on the record about recent studies. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1 to the floor with a due pass. Any comments?
Mr. Chair, please. Thank you. And just briefly, in 31 years of being in law enforcement in Oregon, I dealt frequently with mentally ill people who weren't receiving the treatment they needed. Those people often will put themselves in life-threatening positions where they're a threat to the officer who arrives. The officer may or may not know they're crazy, or I shouldn't use that word, I'm sorry, but they don't know their condition. And even if they do know their condition, if their life's threatened, they're going to react, and it often ends in disaster. And as far as saving money, the disability fund up in Portland, the Police and Fire Disability Fund, began paying for mental health for officers involved and firefighters involved in traumatic situations. And what we found was we saved a ton of money because people were able to continue working rather than going off on disability. When you and I were new in police work, you probably recall that many times an officer who would be involved in a shooting within 5 years would be gone from the job because of the mental health. We also would see mentally ill people on the street. They'd end up on the street because they didn't receive adequate care. And the next thing they'd be involved in is street drugs, alcohol, and it always resulted in a disaster. Senator Gordley and Senator Carter spoke about children and saving the children. And I just made me think of many of the Native American nations prior to the white man even arriving here, when they would look at the future and they would talk about what a decision they were going to make, how it would affect the future, they would think 8 generations out. And if we get mental health parity, get people treated early, and make productive citizens out of them, 8 generations from now, we're going to be so much better off than we are today. It's just unbelievable, and I'm going to be a very strong yes vote on this.
Yeah. Staff, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1 moves the floor with a due pass, and we'll assign Representative Flores and Boone to carry, please. And we will be adjourned until until a little after 1 o'clock, probably about 1:10. We have a conference committee, and then we'll be back to do 1083.
Federal Affairs, Thursday, July 28, 2005. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 1083. And Mr. Taylor, can you kind of tell us the changes that have taken place since we set the bill aside yesterday or the day before?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, the bill creates credit against personal and corporate income tax liability for increased labor costs associated with the annual inflation base increases in Oregon's minimum wage, limits the credit to employers in farming activity as defined as crop, livestock, and horticultural production, explicitly excludes forestry, with the exception of Christmas trees, stabilizes equines, breeding greyhounds, for racing and aquatic species product from credit eligibility, allows credit to be carried forward for 5 years. Bill effectively sunsets January 2010.
Okay. And this basically aligns, Council, the revenue up with the existing bill as it was written. And we're talking about the words minimum wage, all others, the cumulative thing. This gets it lined up so it covers it.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I've had discussions with Paul Warner. I've discussed this bill with the Legislative Council's office, and I believe that the revenue statement that you have before you more accurately reflects the bill as than the original one that you had before you. Needless to say that if the bill is enacted into law, it will be the ultimate decider of what the bill means. It will be the court.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move SB 1083A to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved SB 1083A to the floor with the due pass. Discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. With the bill of $119 million in the 2007-2009, we're going to send a bill to the governor to be vetoed. I wish we could rework this and make some sense out of it. I think this thing took off on the right idea, and then it suddenly went astray. Agriculture in Oregon needs help with the minimum wage increase, and the voters passed the minimum wage increase overwhelmingly. Therefore, we should, all of us need to accept some of the responsibility for that. I believe what we ought to be looking at is exempting agriculture from those increases, but not granting a tax credit for everybody on the farm payroll. This is just going to be too costly. We're going to have every small business coming in saying, I need relief as well. And I just think the governor's going to end up having to veto this the way it is. I wish we could fix it and send him something he could pass that would help our agriculture industry.
Okay. Your objections noted?
Mr. Chair, I'm really in the same vein with Representative Barker. We do have a real problem here because we have a collision between a social policy that I think is a good one, which is that an hour of labor in our state should be worth a certain amount, and it shouldn't be diminished over time with inflation. But the impact of that on the agricultural sector is, I think, deeply troublesome. And so we need a fix. I look at this fix here, and it's a revenue impact. I just unfortunately can't support today.
So noted. Any further discussion? Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1083A moves to the floor with the due pass. Representative Flores, I'll have you co-carry with Representative Klopp.
Thank you, sir.
Please. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1083 and close the committee for the day. And we're due up at 9 a.m. in the morning?
Aye.
Nine.
Nine?
Okay.
Nine.
Thank you.